This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. We've heard it from the NRA.
The only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
And lately from President Trump.
One night in 2015, she was home alone with her two-year-old daughter when an intruder broke into her home violently. April took care of it.
More than 2 out of 5 Americans either own a gun or live with someone who does. Nearly 3/4 of gun owners say they mainly own that firearm for protection. Now, there's not much data on self-defensive gun use, but researchers at Harvard recently found that people defended themselves with their guns in less than 1% of crimes. Less than 1%. But what's it like to be in that number? One such person spoke to Jonathan Levinson. He's a reporter for Guns and America, based at Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, and he joins us now to talk about it. Jonathan, welcome to 1A.
Hey, Joshua.
So the man you spoke to is named Brennan Pebbles. Tell us about him.
Pebbles. He's from Oregon. He's a bartender at a brewery out in Bend. He and his brother and his friends, they go shooting, he said, probably about 10 times a year, mostly for fun, shooting at targets. But he also thought it was important to be familiar with firearms and to not be scared of them.
Now, he says he defended himself with his gun last October. Tell us what happened.
So Pebbles was finishing up his shift at work. His roommate texted him and said someone had broken into their house. His roommate had chased him out, and Pebbles thought this was very unusual, and his roommate was kind of freaking out, understandably. He rushed home, and they were standing in their kitchen. He was sort of calming him down. They were going to call the police, and then a shot came through the front window, hit his roommate, and Pebbles ran upstairs.
And then immediately just kind of grabbed my gun and started to think, like, do I jump out the window? No, I can't get out the window because he's going to hear me. He's going to see me. And then I heard him coming through the window, and then all the crunching noises sounded like a bunch of ice cubes were dropping on hardwood floor. And that, to me, was the moment where I was like, oh, God, this is life or death right now. And then I heard him run up the stairs and then came into my bedroom. And that's when I saw his AR-15. And it was one of those life or death decisions that you choose to live or you choose to die. You don't stop and smell the roses and say, after what I saw, and that's what I told the investigators, of after what I saw and what happened, there was no question. It was either life or death.
So he runs in, he sees this guy with an AR-15. What happened when he opened fire?
Yeah, so he was hiding in his bathroom, and like he said, as soon as he saw the guy come in, he shot him from about 6 feet away. The man died. Police told Pebbles that he'd fired 4 times, and Pebbles said that some of the shots missed.
How did Pebbles react? I mean, did he feel ready for this?
He said he was terrified.
In the moment that it happened, yes, I was completely terrified, shaking, just panic, you know, swearing, and like, what the hell is happening? Like, this is insane. Absolutely insane. And the feeling, I mean, I felt just sheer panic, you know? What else do you feel in those moments of complete chaos? Complete chaos.
He said that the question of, am I prepared? It had occurred to him when he bought his handgun. He even looked around his house for blind spots and places to hide.
There is no preparation for something that happens so randomly. And you can't. Yeah, I mean, in my own mind, I was like, okay, well, I have a firearm, so I'm ready if something ever happens. It won't, because that's how we all think. It's not going to happen to me. But it did happen to me. And was I prepared? Not really.
So, Jonathan, it's interesting. Even though things turned out in Brennan Pebbles' favor, as it were, he lived and the assailant died, he still doesn't feel prepared. Almost feels like he's kind of lucky, in a way, to have successfully defended himself with a firearm. Zooming out from his story, what do we know more generally about the difficulty of doing something like this?
Yeah, these scenarios are phenomenally challenging, and they're phenomenally challenging to prepare for as well. Again, Pebbles missed a few times, he said, from 6 feet away, but that's not really a reflection on his marksmanship. It says quite a bit more about how much adrenaline impacts motor function, being able to load a weapon, being able to aim it and acquire a sight picture. This is the reason that police and the military try so hard to induce stress during training, things like sleep deprivation and physical exertion, because the enormous adrenaline response that happens in these life-threatening situations, it really impairs your ability to do even the most basic things. There was a study in 2006 in a journal called Police Quarterly. It looked at New York City police officers' exchange of gunfire, and they found that officers missed 82% of the time when they were being shot at. I spoke with an Army major, Chris Klein, about his experience. He used to be in a Ranger unit, which is a special operations unit. He talked about a drill called Ready Ups. Soldiers stand about 50 feet from a target, and in quick succession, they raise their rifle, switch the safety off, aim, fire two rounds, and put the rifle back on safe. Infantry soldiers do these all the time. They do it with live ammo at the range, and they do it without ammo. Whenever there's downtime, you know, let's go outside, do some ready ups. It's just drilled into your muscle memory. And even then, things don't go as planned. And this is Major Klein talking about his first firefight in Iraq.
It took quite a few shots before I took the fundamentals of marksmanship in, took a breath, and then squeezed the trigger. And so that was a huge amount of time to like get that in my mind, because I was so pumped up on adrenaline that it took a while to like process it. And then I'm like, oh, wait, if I'm ever going to hit anything, I need to breathe, get a sight picture, squeeze the trigger.
So even with all that training, even with the understanding of what adrenaline does to you in a situation where you need to focus and fire, his platoon still struggled with accuracy, right?
Yeah, and it wasn't just that moment he described it. This is what he said about an incident. They saw someone placing an IED on the side of the road.
The whole platoon came up, or it was actually a section, half a platoon, and got online, and we all started firing. So we're now at like nine soldiers firing, one with a 240 medium machine gun, and we did not hit them. I mean, it's like they were 400 meters away. By the time I got up there and I started shooting with, you know, no sights, I had a designated marksman, which was an M14 with a 10 power Leupold scope, a 240 machine gun, and none of us hit him. And, I kind of had to take inventory after that. Like, what is it? Is it that, you know, the humanity exists in my soldiers, they don't want to kill somebody? Is it the training that they can't hit somebody? And so I still wrestle with that to this day.
So we've talked about the physical toll of even trying to shoot another person. What about the mental and psychological toll? Is there research that shows how that works?
There is, and it goes a little bit beyond just PTSD. I talked to Matt Gray, a psychologist at the University of Wyoming. He studies combat-related trauma and something called moral injury. The way he described killing, he said it's the ultimate human taboo.
All societies, all cultures through all eras, for the most part, maybe some exceptions, religious rituals and what have you, but for the most part, this is something that people have a lifetime of moral training, socialization, and acculturation that deems that the ultimate taboo. Murder, taking a life, something like that. Even in, you know, self-defense, it's something that we deem to be at odds with normal morality.
The context that it happens in really matters in terms of emotional, psychological impact. He referred to moral ambiguity as this key aspect. He said that if someone can replay an incident in their heads, if they can envision other courses of action that they could have taken that would have resulted in a different outcome, they're more likely to feel guilt and self-blame. So if, for example, if Pebbles could replay that incident and foresee different things he could have done that would have maybe meant that he didn't have to take that life, that would be more traumatic in the long run.
That might be a good place to wrap up the story of Brennan Pebbles. I mean, how did he handle the impact of shooting that intruder in retrospect?
Yeah, and this ties in perfectly with what Dr. Gray was saying. Pebbles didn't have a choice. He talked about he wanted to jump out the window but couldn't. There's nothing he could have done differently in that situation and still survived. He has a supportive family. He has a pastor that he talks to. And all of this might help explain why, you know, he acknowledges it was a traumatic event, but he is looking forward. He doesn't want to dwell on the past.
Pulling a trigger is something that nobody should ever have to do. I mean, it's impossible to describe, because it's real people, and it sucks. And, you know, I chose to live. I don't hate the individual who did this. I hate what he did. You know, and it's my heart still is heavy for both families involved, because these are real people. It's not easy. It's not easy. I'll never take it for granted that I survived something and two individuals didn't.
The story of Brennan Pebbles as told to Jonathan Levinson, a reporter for Guns and America based out of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland. Jonathan, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, Joshua.
Just ahead, we know that saving yourself with a gun is vanishingly rare. So why does that good guy with a gun myth persist? We'll ask the experts in just a moment. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Bayer. From advances in health to innovations in agriculture, Bayer is advancing science for a better life. Because someone with heart issues should still be able to have their heart jump with joy. Because a farmer using less water should still be able to grow their crops. Because someone getting older should still be able to act young. At Bayer, this is why we science.
I know we'd all love the holidays to be this happy, stress-free, joyful time, but let's be real, that is not always the case. NPR's Life Kit is answering your holiday questions and helping you navigate family dynamics all season long. New episodes every Tuesday and Thursday. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit, all guides.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Watch an action movie, binge a spy thriller, play a video game that's a first-person shooter, and you might think that using a gun to defend yourself is kind of a no-brainer. But research shows that people in the real world who are victims of actual crimes rarely defend themselves with a firearm. Very, very rarely. According to Harvard, people defend themselves with a gun in less than 1% of all violent crimes. Less than 1%. But nearly three-fourths of gun owners say the reason they have a gun is self-protection. Now, we just heard the story of a man who was part of that less than 1%. Now, let's broaden the scope and talk about the rest of us. Jonathan Metzl is the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University, and he joins us from Vanderbilt. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
You've been studying this for some decades now. What do we know now about how often people use firearms in self-defense?
Well, the data we just heard is not surprising to me at all. I've spent a lot of time interviewing gun owners over the course of my research, and I can understand that there is a profound psychological or emotional sense that people who are gun owners feel safer and more self-protected when they have weapons in their house or on their person. But the data shows again and again that actually, if you're in a moment of criminal encounter, a mass shooting or a crime or something like that, it just happens so quickly that we see with mass shootings in Texas and other places where a lot of people own guns, but these are shocking situations and they happen very quickly. And in those moments, people just aren't able to, you know, like they do in the movies, whip out and a gun and shoot themselves. And the data that I look at really shows that the bigger risk is of owning a gun, really. So there's a kind of disconnect between the real world and what's actually happening.
Dig a little deeper into those interviews with gun owners. Can you paint me a picture of what they think or what they expect or perceive might happen if they ever needed to defend themselves with their firearm?
Sure. Well, in my book, Dying of Whiteness, I interviewed a lot of people in basically very pro-gun red states and in areas where there were a lot of weapons. And I would ask people, you know, tell me first of all about how, what are the roles of guns in your daily life? And people would tell me, well, I feel safer when I carry a gun outside the home for me. But then there were also stories of people who had guns on their nightstands, under their beds. Some people had guns actually on their headboards, just in case something happened at night. And I would ask, well, why is that? And repeatedly they would tell me, you know, somebody could break into my home through my window at night. They could, you know, steal my big screen TV or attack my family or carjack me. But again and again, when I would ask people, did that actually happen, at least in my research, and that's borne out by the research of other social scientists, there were very few examples of that happening. So it was more about the sensation of safety rather than actual evidence that having a gun in a moment like that was a form of self-protection.
And that sensation of safety, I wonder if it was safety the way that you might have like a fire alarm or a fire extinguisher, where you say, you know, it's probably not going to happen, but I'd rather have it and not need it than need it and not have it? Or do they actually believe that something will happen to them where they will need a gun?
Well, there are two important factors to think about when you answer a question like that. First of all, there's a bigger cultural shift that's happened in this country. So, you know, several decades ago, when you would ask gun owners, why do you have a gun? Most gun owners at that time said that they needed a gun for hunting, and very few people felt like they needed a gun for personal protection. And because of a series of changes in our laws, in Supreme Court decisions, but really just massive changes thanks to the NRA and marketing and factors like that, there really has been quite a shift. And now, according to Pew and other places, the majority of gun owners feel like they need a gun for protection against other people, and the minority say that they need a gun for hunting. The research I've done shows that actually this is an inversion. So the actual risk is far greater. In other words, if you have a gun in your home, you're at far greater risk of an accidental shooting or a gun suicide or some kind of unfortunate event that happens because you have a gun in your house. So the greater risk is actually from you in a way. And so this idea of fearing others is a direct inversion of at least what a lot of the data shows is the actual risk, which is having something unfortunate happen within your own household.
Why is it that if so many Americans own guns, and I say many, relatively speaking, of course, relative to other, you know, developed so-called first world nations per capita, why is it that if so many Americans own guns that we use them so rarely in self-defense?
Well, that's one thing that's been lost in the whole gun debate. Most guns are not fired, right? And so, you know, I think that there hasn't been a lot of research on why people don't shoot guns. But I would say that there's been a tremendous shift in not just why people own guns, but in the messaging around them. Even if you look at, for example, advertisements for weapons or the kinds of laws that we pass, if you think, for example, about stand your ground laws or things like that, they're all about fearing this encounter. Now, I understand, believe me, these encounters, on some ways, you know, the fear of something like a mass shooting happening to you or at your kid's school or something is really terrifying. But I do feel like there's been a dramatic amount of really mis-messaging about this factor, and people really are being sold on the idea that guns are going to be protective in particular situations when that's not the case.
And before we keep going into self-defense, you talked about most gun owners or most people who are killed by guns are killed by gun suicides. What's the ratio there? Is it dramatically more suicide than, say, homicides or self-defense? What's the proportion like?
It's pretty shocking. You know, we have around 40,000 gun deaths a year in this country, and fully two-thirds of those deaths are gun suicides. So we're looking at about 23, 24, 25,000 gun suicides. So even though, again, for understandable reasons, mass shootings and homicides get all the news, the real epidemic is gun suicide in this country. And the demographics of gun suicide are very important to think about. I mean, again, having a gun on your person or in your house is a risk factor. It trends toward white men, which is what I write about in my book. So white men who are gun owners are also the people who are at higher risk of gun suicide. And I just think in this conversation, it's important to think about that because it's a direct inversion of, as we were saying, the reasons why people feel like they own guns in the first place.
Let's talk about self-defense with a firearm. Now, I've gotten to do, you know, police firearm simulator, one of those like big high-tech gun simulators at the Oakland Police Department in California. It's amazingly hard to do, But I don't think unless you've actually tried to do it, even in a simulation, you get the mechanics of just why it's so difficult. Could you talk us through that? Like, walk us through some of the challenges of having to defend yourself with a firearm.
Well, again, I've never personally had to defend myself with a firearm. So I know from the research I'd done, that, you know, bullets come at you very quickly. Shootings happen very quickly. And so I think that the idea of this is that at a moment when you're encountering with a bad guy with a gun, some good guy with a gun will be able to kind of whip out their weapon and defend themselves. What we've seen in actual real world instances, number one, are when people whip out their guns and start shooting in moments of tense encounter, they're very indiscriminate about where the bullets go. And so there's a lot of kind of correlate shootings and factors like that. And so I guess the most important point is that there's really not a ton of evidence. There was a book, More Guns, Less Crime, a while ago by someone who was arguing for more guns. But I think that when you really dig down deep, there's not a ton of evidence. And the reason I think that's important is because think of all the places in our country now where we're pushing guns into public spaces with the presupposition that guns will be effective. We're arming teachers right now, for example. In Tennessee, where I live, we allow people to open carry guns, near schools and parks and bars and public. All of this is done with the assumption that people will be able to defend themselves if something bad happens. Unfortunately, there's no research, really. And so in a way, there's a great disconnect between what people are doing, which is allowing guns into all of these public spaces, and the answer to your question, which is, honestly, we don't know. We don't know the mechanism through which people defend themselves, but the anecdotal evidence is not great in suggesting that it's helpful to have a gun when there's a shooting going on.
It just seems like such a Herculean stack of qualities and attributes and skills that you have, that unless you're trained for it and have a badge on your chest, it just seems like a tall order.
Well, I mean, again, there are many anecdotal stories of heroism in the line of fire, so I don't want to discount that. But I think you're absolutely right. And the other part of that is just the element of surprise that happens in many of these shootings. And we've seen it even in the mass shootings in Texas. It happens more quickly. And so, I think from where I sit, we're better off thinking about, bigger prevention strategies. You know, how can we stop guns from getting in the hands of the wrong people rather than thinking that everybody's going to whip out their firearm and start firing in this split second moment.
So defending yourself with a gun is relatively extraordinarily rare. Why do 3/4 of Americans still believe in it enough to say that it's their primary reason for ownership?
Well, I certainly interviewed a lot of people in my research who felt like a gun had become – I mean, there were long traditional reasons. You know, guns had been passed down in their families. They'd always had guns in the home. They felt safer having a gun in their home because they felt like they could protect themselves better than the police could or somebody coming. And I don't want to discount that. And so I think there was a tremendous psychological benefit for many of the people that I interviewed about guns being a form of autonomy, of self-protection. For a lot of the men I interviewed, it was about protecting their families. And you see those kind of stories if you look at literature that is supportive of gun rights. People will basically say, you know, it's our duty to respect ourselves and our families. So I do think there's a long tradition about the psychological benefits that people who have grown up in this tradition feel about protecting themselves. Unfortunately, the flip side of this is that there was a lot of what I call construction of imaginary threats. So in other words, when I would ask people, so tell me, you know, how you might use a gun, and people would tell me stories that were very often racialized stories about, you know, a carjacker could come at me, a gangbanger could break into my window and steal my television or threaten my family, these very racially tinged stories. But when I would ask people, well, has that ever happened? At least in my research, nobody had ever had that happen to them. And so, you know, there's a tension between respecting traditions and really, I think, the importance of pushing back on the reasons that people imagine they feel like they need guns in the first place.
I don't know if you asked them about this, but in the circumstance where they say, you know, they might steal my television or jack my car or take something from me, do they ever contemplate maybe just giving it up, just like letting the thief take what they want?
Well, these stories are not just coming from them. I mean, if you look at NRA rhetoric, for example, you know, the whole good guy with a gun story that the NRA tells actually uses these same terms, you know, carjackers and gangbangers and things like that. And if people want that citation, I cite all of this material in my book. And so in a way, you know, again, I think it's a double-edged sword, right? On one hand, you want to be respectful of traditions of gun ownership. But I do also think that there's a reason why we've had cultural shifts in this country that shifted assumptions about guns from hunting to fearing other people. And those shifts are about bigger cultural messages that are being pushed by, you know, the NRA and other places, and also just about, as I was mentioning before, just a lot of anxiety about factors like race and safety and things like that. And so, again, it's a bigger cultural conversation. And really, you know, you want to be balanced about this, right? So I think really what we need is more research before we start pushing guns into all of these public places like schools without any evidence that this is effective, because otherwise we're just going on these myths and these fantasies.
I'm sure there are plenty of thoughtful people maybe listening to this who would say, I get it. It's super vanishingly unlikely that I will ever use my gun to defend myself or need to use it or be able to use it. But all it takes is one time when it would make a difference in saving my life, the life of my spouse, the life of my child, the life of my parent, and I'm a responsible gun owner, I know what I'm doing, I know I probably won't need to use it, but it's better to have it and not need it than to need it and not have it. What would you say to them?
You know, there's a tension in this whole gun debate between kind of the individual and the cultural. So again, like when I talk to people about this, I'm very respectful of that story. I mean, I think it's hard to be critical of people's desire to protect themselves and their families.
But the story statistically is most likely wrong. If you stand a 99-point-something% chance of never being able to fire a gun to save your own life, why aren't we talking about other ways of saving our lives, like running, surrendering, complying, improving law enforcement in your community?
Like if you don't want to die of gun death, the safest thing you can do is live in a state that has tight gun laws and live in a state that is surrounded by states that have tight gun laws. There was a great study in the British Medical Journal a couple of months ago that shows that states that have tight gun laws and are surrounded by states that have tight gun laws have far fewer mass shootings than states that have open or liberal gun laws. That's true about, you know, in my book, I show that states that have tight gun laws have fewer gun suicides. That's also true of everything from police shootings, accidental shootings, homicides. So the safest thing you can do is live in a state that has common sense gun laws. It has nothing to do with the individual. It has to do with the communal. And that's why I mentioned that really the debate about guns in America is this tension between the individual and the communal. But if you were just driven by data, you know, live in New York, right? It's a lot safer than living in Tennessee.
And just to be clear, when you say liberal gun laws, you're talking about permissive gun laws, not
permissive. That's right. Exactly right.
Before exactly I let right. you go, even if people did accept that they probably would not need a gun to defend themselves, how much would that cut down on the number of guns in circulation in America? Do you think we'd give them up?
We have more than one gun for every citizen of this country. If you aggregate it up, the United States is about 4.5% of the world's population, but we own almost 50% of the world's civilian-owned firearms. So we have a massive arsenal already in society. There are other countries like Australia, for example, that have done what are called gun buyback programs.
Right.
I don't think that would be effective in the United States, to be honest. But the lesson of Australia is that people across the political spectrum, conservatives, liberals, everybody got together and said, enough is enough. How can we come together? And so, I don't think a gun buyback program is going to happen in the U.S. anytime soon. But until we have really constructive, meaningful, bipartisan conversations where we're actually saying, let's join together to address this, it's not going to reduce the epidemic that we're seeing.
And what do you think would be the last straw here? Australia began to change its gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre in 1996. We have had three mass shootings in Texas in the last year or so, Sutherland Springs, El Paso, and Odessa. A few dozen kids got killed in Newtown, and we still haven't reached that point. Based on your research, what's the tipping point look like?
Well, you know, on one hand, it seems like every moment feels like the last straw, and then we end up it seems like falling back into the same patterns. Optimistically, I would hope that there's a cumulative effect. It's not just going to be one effect. It's really a broad cultural shift toward addressing some of these questions in constructive ways. And so, you know, I'm hopeful that we're heading in that direction, but really, I think the jury's still out.
Jonathan Metzl is the director of the Center for Medicine, Health, and Society at Vanderbilt University and the author of Dying of Whiteness, How the Politics of Racial Resentment is Killing America's Heartland. Jonathan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the number of women who are buying guns has surged over the last 5 years. A lot of it has to do with self-defense. We'll discuss why that is in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Rosie Perez, the actress and dancer, has some words to live by.
Life's too short to drink the house wine. Go downstairs and get the good stuff, honey.
That's on Bullseye right now from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Let's get back to our conversation about gun culture and self-defense. It's part of a special collaboration with Guns and America, a reporting project dedicated to exploring the relationship between the United States and firearms. Joining us now from WABE Public Radio in Atlanta is Lisa Hagan, a reporter for Guns and America. Lisa recently spoke with several women who've survived violence about their relationships with guns. Lisa, welcome to 1A.
Hi, Joshua. Thanks for having me.
First of all, what do we know about how many American women own guns compared with American men, and also about their motivations for owning firearms?
Right. So it's always important to be really careful about gun ownership estimates. There's no census for this. There's no real way for us to know. But what we do have is some polling. So according to Pew, the most recent estimate is something like 1 in 5 American women report that they own a gun. And that's compared to 3 in 5 men. So we do believe that women own fewer guns. And folks talk about that number, the number of women gun ownership, that number is rising, but that whole thing is a little bit up for debate because, again, we don't have hard data about this. And a lot of the folks putting out numbers about more female gun owners tend to be the gun industry itself, which doesn't mean that there's nothing to learn there, but it's not peer-reviewed science.
So we've mentioned a few times now that 3/4 of gun owners are buying firearms for self-protection, as they say. How does that tie into why women buy guns?
Same thing. What we see is both men and women are very interested in owning guns for self-protection. And the researchers I talked to said that that's been true for about 2 decades, according to polling. And so being around the gun industry and gun culture, I was always really fascinated by how that self-protection aspect is marketed specifically to women, like in ads, in stories that get told about why women need guns. And what you hear a lot is that there's this an idea that women are especially vulnerable, usually to men who are attacking them. And usually it's strange men, which I think is a common narrative, whether or not you're talking about the world of guns. You know, the world feels like a dangerous place for a lot of women. So this really powerful idea exists within the gun world that guns are an equalizer for women or anyone who might be sort of less able-bodied than an adult male attacker. Here's a recent example of that story being told from the last NRA meeting. You might recognize the speaker.
April Evans joins us from Virginia. One night in 2015, she was home alone with her 2-year-old daughter when an intruder broke into her home violently. April took care of it. April, please come up.
So that's President Trump this past spring at the NRA annual convention in Indianapolis. And here's the woman he introduces, April Evans. She tells the crowd she was at home with her daughter, her husband's at work.
Someone started banging so hard on the door, it broke in two places. He demanded that I let him in. I called 911 and I went to my room to get the gun. I heard a loud crash, and when I came out to the hallway to see, he was running towards me with a look in his eyes that I'll never forget. I shot him twice, and I held him at gunpoint until the police arrived.
Crowd goes totally wild. And I think you can hear, you know, that's a pretty powerful story, both for Evans to be able to tell about her own survival, but also for the NRA members in the crowd. You know, this is why they're there advocating for this right, so that women can protect themselves.
You said that the concern is usually about a stranger attacking, much like what happened to April Evans. But based on what we know, that's not necessarily a representative example of what the crime data shows us, right? Most crimes against women involve people they know.
Right. That's exactly right. And I want to be really clear. I'm not saying that things like April experienced there are never happen. It is terrifying and awful and real for anyone who experiences something like that. But it's just not the most common way that women face violence. According to the FBI, attacks from strangers make up less than a third of violent crimes against women. Men are slightly more likely to be victimized by a stranger, but it's closer to 50-50. So the vast majority of violence we know that we as women face come from people we know. Something like 3 out of 5 who are violent crime victims knew their attacker. So I started talking to professionals who work with women who've survived violence, like sexual assault, domestic violence, and I asked, you know, what do you advise as far as guns and self-protection? Would you ever recommend guns in a case like this? And the answer I got was mixed, and they sort of respond by saying, you know, most sexual assaults, it's not an ongoing issue. You are assaulted, and it's not going to be something that you are going to come back and shoot that person again in another situation. And as far as domestic violence, of course, that's an ongoing situation of mental and psychological abuse, and guns are not going to solve an unhealthy emotional entanglement, is what I heard.
Isn't there also research that shows a gun in any home increases the risk of violence for women?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's lots of research that's been confirmed over and over again since the 90s. So knowing that, I think it's easy to wonder, why would any woman invite that risk into their lives by owning a gun? But then I started talking to women themselves who have been through something terrible, women who own guns.
One of those women was Janet Paulson. She was shot by her estranged husband after she asked him for a divorce. What happened to her?
Yeah, so Janet was married for several years to a man who was an alcoholic. She asked him for a divorce, and one day around 2015, she came home to find him waiting to ambush her.
He had parked his truck 2 neighborhoods away, and he trudged through these woods back here, and he was waiting for me on the side of the house with a holster. He had a holster on, and he brought an extra box of ammunition with him. So I pulled in the driveway just like we did. I happened to have groceries in my car. I was at football practice with my dad and the boys. So I came home early by myself and I opened the garage door like I just did. I hit it to come down and I saw it kind of kick up in the rearview mirror. And I thought, well, that's weird. And I went to get out of the car. I grabbed this door handle and he was leaning against that wall, cocking the gun. And I was like, did I just see that? And then I saw him start to move, and this other voice took over and said, get out of this garage or you're dead. So I slammed the car in reverse. I hit the gas as hard as I could, and I busted through the door. It was almost all the way down. I was trying to get to the street, but I hit that tree in my neighbor's yard.
So she got out of the crashed car, and she started running.
I was trying to get to that neighbor's house that way. You know, I felt stinging my abdomen. I knew I'd been hit a couple times. Then I was like, I didn't want to drop in the woods. I was like scared no one would find me or whatever. So I cut back up this embankment, and when I hit the crest of it, that's when he shot me in the leg. And then when I got to the middle of the driveway, that's when he shot me in the leg again, and I fell over. And then the last shot hit my spinal cord. And he just stood at the edge of the driveway in the grass right there. Yeah. I was lying in the middle of the driveway. I mean, they were all at close range.
Yeah.
You know, and I watched him do it.
He shot her 6 times, paralyzing her in one leg, and then he killed himself.
Does Janet think that having a gun would have helped in that situation?
No. And she's given it a lot of thought. She says that she was focused on getting away. So she does not think that having a gun would have helped in that situation. But then she started telling me about her recovery. And along with everything else she had to deal with, she'd been in a coma, she had to learn how to live this new life. There was this tremendous trauma that she was suddenly living with.
And that's when she buys a gun, as I understand it, and learned to shoot. Why'd she do that?
I was having pretty bad PTSD at the time, which I still do, but it's not as bad as it was. And everywhere I looked, I was waiting for someone to pull a gun on me again. You know, I'd see something out of the corner of my eye, and in my brain, it was someone coming with a firearm. So I decided to kind of grab hold of the thing that was haunting me. And the images that I used to have of seeing him cocking that gun and pointing it at me, they kind of faded after I went through that training. And instead, the view was from behind the gun, with me holding the gun. And, you know, probably for about 6 months after that training, and this was in 2017, I was shot in late 15, you know, I carried that gun in my handbag.
So her ex-husband had owned more than 70 guns before all of this went down in the house that they lived in together. And that's kind of a whole different story. But the point is that she didn't have any warm feelings about firearms beforehand. She was starting to use one to heal. And that's where I feel like this all gets really complicated and emotional.
Do you feel like having a gun makes you safe?
No.
Yeah.
Like I said, I have a healthy respect for firearms. Doesn't make me feel completely safe, but there is a small sense of security knowing that if I could get to it. Like, mostly, you know what I think about? If someone broke in my house, you know, in the middle of the night. That's when I think I would be able to use it and, you know, use it effectively.
You know, it's like, what can you really say to that? Hey, the crime data shows that you're not as likely to be attacked by a stranger. She's already lived through almost being murdered by your husband. She is one of those statistics. So she's got a really complicated relationship with her gun. And she advocates now in Georgia for getting guns away from domestic abusers. And yet she feels really, really strongly about her own right to own a gun for self-protection.
You also did some reporting, Lisa, on what happens with women who do use a gun to protect themselves. Tell us about Marissa Alexander. What happened with her?
Right. So this was a very big story in criminal justice circles. She's a Florida woman who was sentenced to 20 years for firing a warning shot into the ceiling to ward off an abusive husband. This incident happened in 2010. Marissa was raised around guns. Her dad was an Army vet. And when she started carrying as an adult, it was because she was taking evening classes for a master's degree. And she bought a 9mm Glock for protection. And again, this was against strangers. One day, her husband got jealous of an ex-boyfriend, started beating her and saying that he was going to kill her. So she runs to the garage, gets out of her car, and fires that shot. She had no prior record, nothing, but she gets arrested, rejects a plea deal because she doesn't feel like she did anything wrong, and then mandatory minimum. When a jury convicted her, she got 20 years. She spent about 3 years incarcerated and finally took a plea deal. So when we talked, she told me while in jail, she started hearing stories like hers from women around her and across the country, a lot of them with really long sentences.
I was encountering women who had been in there since they were young, all the way 20 years. I mean, I'm thinking, my goodness, this has been going on for quite some time. So, you know, that really concerned me because it was a message that said that, you know, your only option is to either take it and hope that you don't get killed or flee the situation. And, you know, in an ideal world, I understand that. But I thought to myself, there's got to be a better way that we are way more preventative and proactive in the way we communicate to, you know, our communities about violence, specifically women.
Lisa, in Marissa Alexander's case, does she believe that the gun saved her life?
Yes, she does.
I believe that that was the only thing that could ward off that attack that day. There is no telling how far that could have went, you know, had I not used it in the way that I did. And I'm grateful that, nobody was injured or killed that day. So I stick to what I did. I did the best that I could. And I believe, you know, with 100% of me that, you know, I could have been left with the alternative, and I don't want to know what that is, and I'm glad I don't have to find that out.
She actually told me if she could legally own a gun again today, she would, and for the same reason, to protect against strangers.
All right, so let's see if we can kind of sum this up. How did you come away from your reporting on women and guns? It seems like women purchase guns for self-protection, but do they in fact make women safer? And for that matter, does that make a difference to them? Do the statistics matter?
I mean, I think it's really complicated. We talked about how many researchers have confirmed consistently that guns are linked to heightened danger for women in particular. But this idea that guns are both empowering for women and can keep us safe from violence, it's not going anywhere. I spoke to a woman named Carrie Lightfoot. She's a firearms instructor who runs this pretty large organization that advises and trains women on guns. It's called the Well-Armed Woman. On her website, she's got all the same statistics about violent crime that we've talked about. But, of course, she frames it more as the world is a dangerous place. If you want to do something about it, you know, we're here to help you get comfortable with a gun. Lightfoot herself was in an abusive relationship, and she was really gracious about sharing that with me. And she bought a gun after that relationship, which seemed when it seemed like he was going to be stalking her.
I think where it gets difficult, really, with the core of this is on an emotional level. This is somebody you know. This is somebody that you perhaps love, or this is somebody who you thought was okay. So there's that whole trying to figure out in an instant, you know, what the heck is going on. You know, I mean, and I struggled with that in my situation. I mean, there were times where, you know, I'd get, you know, crashed on the ground and so forth, and then he'd leave, and then he'd be back at the door, and I'd have the phone in my hand, ready to call 911, you know, but being afraid of that. You know, I haven't fully figured that out, you know, but that's because it's somebody who's behaving like somebody who they're not supposed to be. And you're trying to figure that out. How can this person who professes to love me so much, you know, want to hurt me?
Having a gun in the home increases the risk that a woman is going to be shot by it. It is objectively more dangerous, but talking to Carrie, you know, it might not matter that advice and that crime stats don't really line up with how her gun makes her feel, which is empowered. If a gun makes you feel like there's something tangible you can do to avoid being hurt, that's a powerful message.
Lisa Hagen is a reporter for Guns and America based at WABE Public Radio in Atlanta. Lisa, this is a really tough, complicated subject, but we appreciate you walking us through it. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joshua.
This episode was produced in collaboration with Guns and America, a reporting project dedicated to exploring the relationship between the U.S. and firearms. It's based at WAMU, which is the station that produces 1A. The conversation was edited by Lisa Dunn and AC Valdez, produced by Paige Osborne, and this episode was edited by Miranda Fulmore. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.